Ecclesiastes chapter 3. These are the most popular words from Ecclesiastes. You'll hear them at funerals, Christian and non-Christian alike. Since the late 60s, the birds etched into our culture the first 8 verses with their famous hit, right? To everything, turn, turn, turn. Last Tuesday, I was reading chapter 3 while Abby was at bouldering practice, and a lady peeked over and said, "Those verses are real life." And perhaps that's what draws people to them, real life. Chapter 3 also repeats a word that speaks to the limitations we feel in life. And that word is time. Right? Where does time go, we say? Or, man, time flies. If I just had more time. So we're all bound by time. And that fits how Ecclesiastes opened with that word vanity, breath. We feel the fleeting nature of life under the sun. The clock is always ticking in this world that groans. But the preacher also discovered in his quest, at the end of chapter 2, that life is gift. Food, drink, work, everything is from the hand of God. God wants us to enjoy His world as gift. So time, then, is full of occasions when we are stretched between groaning and gift. Groaning and gift. So how should we think about all that life hurls our way? How does God relate to all that comes to us in time, and what does that mean for how we spend the time we have left? In verses 1 to 15 today of chapter 3, we'll find the answer goes something like this: whatever times God appoints, enjoy good and fear God. Whatever times God appoints, enjoy good and fear God. Let's read it together, beginning in chapter 3, verse 1. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it, so that people fear before Him. That which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Now our passage starts with a poem in verses 1 to 8. The preacher then explains the poem in verses 9 to 11. And that leads to two conclusions in verses 12 to 15, each beginning with the words, I perceived, or I know. And that structure shapes where we're going today. So let's begin with the poem in verses 1 to 8, the times we all face, the times we all face. Hartmut Rosse is a German sociologist. He wrote an intriguing book called The Uncontrollability of the World. According to Rosse, the driving cultural force of that form of life we call modern is the idea that we can make the world controllable. He starts with the simple illustration of snow. We cannot manufacture snow, force it, or even confidently predict it. Take some in your hand, it slips through your fingers. Bring it into the house, it melts away. Pack it away in the freezer, it stops being snow. And yet, there's no shortage of efforts to bring snow under our control. Winter resorts advertise guaranteed snow, making good on their promise with the aid of machines. According to Rosse, Western societies work under a set of assumptions that if we just expand our knowledge of what's there, make it more accessible and manageable, then the world becomes controllable at every level. Of course, the result has become a world in which technological advances are hard to keep up with. Higher, faster, farther, run as fast as you want, the escalator is always going down. To stop is to lose ground. Modernity has an incessant desire to make the world engineerable, predictable, disposable. But here's the rub, according to Rosse. From games to love, from snow to death, human life and human experience are defined by uncontrollability. Now, Rosse doesn't approach this subject from a Christian worldview, from a biblical mindset. But what he observes about the world is as old as Ecclesiastes. We trick ourselves into thinking life is controllable, predictable, when really it's not. And this poem brings us face to face with that reality. Notice the wide swath of experiences in verses 2 through 8. Times that gladden, like birth, harvest, healing, laughter, dance, embracing, mending, loving, peace. But there are also times like death, killing, breaking down, weeping, mourning, losing, tearing, hating, war. It represents our varied experiences in a world that is both gift and groaning. Also, by switching between opposites. He's using a tool called mirrorism, a way of using two opposites to cover everything in between. Right? When we read something like God created the heavens and the earth, it means and everything in between, right? Or on his law, he meditates day and night. What does that mean? All the time. Well, same here. A time to be born. And a time to die implies, and everything in between. A time to weep and a time to laugh implies, and all the mixture of emotions in between. Verse 1 already hinted at this, didn't it? For everything there is a season. Everything. A time for every matter under heaven. The poem is sweeping all that life brings our way. Now, some have understood these verses as presenting choices we have to make. And it takes wisdom to figure out the right choice for the right time, when to sow, when to tear, when to make war, when to make peace. But that's not what the poem is getting at. Do you choose when to be born? Verse 2. Do you choose when to weep? Verse 4. Do you choose loss? Verse 6. Also, notice the word season in verse 1. The New American Standard translation captures the idea more carefully. There is an appointed time. An appointed time for everything. The poem isn't about humans determining this or that. It's about the times often thrust upon us, quite apart from our readiness or input. Even the back and forth polarities, right, illustrate how life really is. Rejoicing that the pregnancy test showed pink. 10 weeks later, devastated by miscarriage. Laughing together over dinner with friends a year later, weeping due to betrayal. A country enjoys prosperity and peace, and then one leader's decision finds mothers kissing their sons goodbye as they're enlisted for war. We're thrown back and forth, back and forth. That's how the poem reads. And the point is that these times are outside of our control. Try as we may to control the outcomes of relationships, to engineer our perfect dreams, to guarantee children won't go astray, to ensure money is there for the budget, to stay healthy and avoid cancer, the truth is we're not in charge of all that life hurls at us. Life doesn't come at us in neat, predictable ways. It throws us back and forth, torn between a world that is groaning and a world that is gift. Even more, the times we all face leave us with a sense of no gain. The opposites cancel one another out. For birth, there's death. For laughter, there's mourning. For planting, there's harvesting. For peace, there's war. And so when he asks in verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? The implied answer is the same that it was in chapter 1, verse 3, nothing. We're thrown back and forth until time runs out. Have you accepted this wisdom? Because the underlying assumption of our culture is that with enough resources and education and effort and influence and technology, I can control my circumstances. I can guarantee the results. I can engineer the good life. I can protect myself from hurt. And the truth is, we can't. Toil all you want to make it happen, but in the end, you won't be able to figure it out. The times we face are outside our control. But as we keep reading, we learn they might be outside of our control, but they are not outside God's control. And that brings us to verses 9 to 11, where he explains the poem. The times we all face are the times God himself appoints. The times that God appoints. Verse 1 hinted at this. The times we all face are appointed. They are determined for us, quite apart from our own permission or planning. But in verses 10 to 11, the preacher now identifies the one who is above time, the one who's in control of time. Like I said the other day, the preacher observes the world from three vantage points. The world is groaning, the world as gift, and now the world is God's. Look at verse 10. He says, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. And in saying this, Ecclesiastes touches on a doctrine we call providence. Providence. The new dictionary of theology defines providence like this. The beneficent outworking of God's sovereignty, whereby all events are directed and disposed to bring about the purposes of glory and good for which the universe was made. All events directed and disposed. God didn't just wind up the clock of our universe and let it go. No, he's intimately involved with everything. The everything in verse 11 points back to the everything in verse 1. God is the chief actor behind verses 2 through 8. He's over life and death, springtime and harvest, laughter and sorrow, mourning and dancing, war and peace, and everything in between. Nothing in your life happens outside his control. Verse 11 says that he even designs a kind of beauty into everything that happens. Now, on the ground, within the bounds of time, we can't see this beauty. We can't figure it all out. We ask things like, why are you doing it this way? Why does it have to be this way? Why did you put us through this? Why hasn't my illness gone away? Why didn't my daughter stay? How could this possibly be part of a good plan? We long to know. And that's the struggle, isn't it, in verse 11? He says, God has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. God has put eternity into man's heart, yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to end. We can only see a few parts, but the whole remains hidden. God has composed a beautiful symphony, and it'll all make sense in the end. But perhaps right now, all we're hearing is a B-flat. Pounded over and over again by one of the instruments in the third chair of the violin section. Or to use a different illustration from Bobby Jameson, your life is a tapestry, but you get to see only the reverse side. You find frayed ends of threads and glimpses of muffled blurs. Only the weaver gets to see the whole picture. And that might be harder for some to accept. God keeps it hidden? On purpose? God makes it so that I can't figure it out? Why does God do it this way? Perhaps you've even been tempted to resent him for this. But a few things to remember. One is our creatureliness. We must face what it means to be God's creatures. He is in a category all by himself. He is above time, and he is not subject to its limitations as we are. He knows, as Isaiah tells us, the end from the beginning. We should also remember our sinfulness. You know, often we take what revelation God has given and we suppress it, or we twist it, or we fail to act on it. God owes us nothing. That he keeps revealing himself to sinners at all shows how patient and merciful he is. Also, these truths are needed to put us in our place. The nature of sin is to de-God God. We want control. We can run the world better than God. That's what sin says. But just look where that's gotten us. The fight to control, to play God instead of submitting to God, has plunged humanity into all kinds of evils. God planted eternity in your heart, yet limits you in time so that you conclude, he is God and I am not. When we don't know, it must be enough for us that God knows. When times confound us, we must remember that God is in control and we are not. Wisdom learns to live inside the limits of not knowing. Not that C.S. Lewis ever made this a point in his Chronicles of Narnia, but it would be like Lucy having to trust that C.S. Lewis knows what he's doing when he has the witch kill Aslan on the stone table. But even that's not all we can say. Because the one writing our story, unlike C.S. Lewis, the one writing our story also entered our story. The very God who is above time, who is transcendent and not bound by time, like us, He also entered time on your behalf in the person of Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 and 5 put it this way, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons." Romans 5, 6, "For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly." In the person of Jesus, God entered your struggle in time. There was a time when He was born and a time when He died. There was a time when God empowered Him to heal, and there was a time when He was killed. There was a time when He experienced the disciples' love, and a time when He experienced the Pharisees' hatred. There was a time He feasted with sinners, and a time He mourned the death of a friend. Some embraced Him, and others refrained from embracing Him. There were even things that in His human nature, Jesus did not fully know. Like when He said, "Concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only." All He needed to know to remain faithful, He knew it. And for the things He didn't know, it was enough for Him that His Father knew. There were times that required Jesus to speak, and there were times that required Him to refrain from speaking, like a lamb led to slaughter. So He opened not His mouth. In other words, God isn't someone who simply tells you these things from outside of time. He gets what you're going through in time. He entered your struggle in the person of Jesus. And why did He enter that struggle? Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 to 16 say, "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." So Jesus entered your struggle in time to become your helper through time. How many days do you have left? How many heartbeats will there be left for you? He will be there for every one of them. What will life hurl at you this week? There will be grace for you in every moment of time. Jesus put it this way in Matthew chapter 6, verse 17. "And which of you, by being anxious can add a single hour to his span of life. We're talking about time. An hour. Jesus said, which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? What will you gain by being anxious and trying to control the times? Nothing. But you can trust the one who is above time, who entered time, who now rules time as Alpha and Omega, the beginning and end. You can trust him who sees all of time and whose death and resurrection guarantees that all will be beautiful at the end of time. Think about the times God has appointed for you, the times that have been sweet, as well as the times that have been bitter. Verse 11 covers it all. God has made everything beautiful in its time. We don't see all that God sees, and that means it's harder to grasp how there could be a beauty to some of the absurdities we face. But again, he has not left us without light. Just look at the cross. God makes everything beautiful in its time, even something like the absurdities of the crucifixion of the Son of God. Because of that cross, we gain access to the God above time. Because of that cross, we gain God's help through time. Because of that cross, we'll have glorified bodies at the end of time. And because of that cross, we learn how to spend the rest of our time here in submission to God instead of trying to be God. We've all got more changes coming our way in time. Life is going to keep hurling things at us. We are going to be thrown back and forth between gift and groaning. We are going to be pulled between the two. Some of the twists and turns you're not going to understand. So how are you going to spend the time that you have left? And that brings us to verses 12 to 15. After reflecting on the times God appoints, the preacher draws two conclusions, each beginning with the words, I perceived, or I know. So the first way to spend the days you have left is this, enjoy good. Enjoy good. Verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. That sounds like chapter 2, verse 24. We read that last week. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. You know, seven times in Ecclesiastes, we're told to enjoy the good things God gives. And I have to wonder, are these seven statements about enjoying good, are they recalling the seven times that God said, and it was good? In Genesis chapter 1. Yes, the world is groaning. Yes, you only have so many days left. It says here, as long as they live. But every day you do have left, Ecclesiastes helps us see they're all gifts from our Creator. Don't miss the gifts, he's saying. In this context of time, he's saying don't miss his gifts in the present by worrying about tomorrow. From simple things like eating and drinking to bigger things like work, enjoy these now as good gifts from a generous God. He wants you to enjoy them. Right? Have you ever given someone a gift and they receive it with an attitude of, but what I really wanted was, how much do you think it offends God when we treat his gifts that way? He knows what's best for us. He gives them for us to enjoy now, fully giving our hearts to them in the present. Breath, food, drink, homes, animals, projects, church members, sunsets, rains, flowers, swirling patterns of burl and a piece of walnut. My dad's mesquite smoked barbecue. All of them are here for a limited time only. And yet they're all good gifts to enjoy within time. And wisdom sees both of those things, the limitations and the goodness. You know, when I first was studying this passage last June, it was shortly after some kids left some handprints all over our glass door. And the thought came, you know, when wisdom, I'll tell you how I look at that glass door. It's not with cheerfulness. It's like, I cleaned that just this morning. But when wisdom looks at the dirty glass door, it doesn't complain about handprints. It enjoys the fact that there are hands. And it leans into that. That's why he put it, he phrased it the way he did last week. Make your soul see good in all those moments. Even the mundane things of life are gifts from above. Notice he also adds the idea of doing good. Doing good. Not just enjoying the good gifts, but also doing good to others. Right? Those who enjoy God's generosity, they become generous people themselves. Right, has someone ever surprised you with a gift? Maybe you've been wanting it. Maybe you've dropped hints every now and then, and then they give it to you. Maybe they even go over the top, right? And you receive the gift, and in your joy of receiving it, you come here. You guys gotta play this with me, right? You guys have to try this. Look. Or maybe you receive it and in the mail and, oh, I can't wait to share this with so-and-so. Well, that's how it is when we receive God's good gifts. He owes us nothing, but he lavishes kindness on us all the time. The life of a Christian is one where we can't wait to share the good things that he gives to us. And the best gift that he's given to is himself in the gospel message. How much do we have to share with others with a good gift of the gospel message? We can't wait to take what he's given to us and to do good for others. No matter what time brings our way, wisdom learns to enjoy good and do good. Wisdom also fears God. It fears God. That's the second way to spend the days you have left. Fearing God. Verse 14. I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. So whatever God does can't be changed. You can struggle all you want to control what comes at you, to change the times, but the truth is your toil can't change what God has decided. In chapters 1 to 2, we saw that our work often fails to produce what we desire. Also, it doesn't last. It goes away when we go away. Well, verse 14 shows that God's work endures forever. He always fulfills what he sets out to do. It's like Proverbs 19:21 says, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. Why does God work this way? Why does God frustrate our work with limits while his work lasts forever? And it's to drive us to himself. to cause us to fear before him, it says, meaning we behold him with reverential awe. This fear is not like that of someone who works only because he's scared silly of punishment. It's the fear of a child who wants to please his good father and who finds his judgments to be perfect, true, and good. It's the same fear of the Lord that Proverbs calls the beginning of wisdom. It's the same fear of the Lord that Isaiah promised would characterize the Messiah. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord, Isaiah 11, verse 3. And it's the same fear of the Lord that God promised and gives to us in the new covenant. Jeremiah 31, verse 39. I will give my people one heart and one way that they may fear me forever for their own good. In life under the sun, wisdom doesn't mean knowing everything. It means fearing God when you don't know everything. Instead of acting like we're in control, it means acknowledging that he's in control and trusting him with the future. I think verse 15 helps us with this, even if it's a harder verse to understand. It says, that which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been. Okay, that part's clear, right? He's repeating a point he already developed in chapter 1, verse 9. There's nothing new under the sun. But then he adds this, and God seeks what has been driven away. At least this is the way the ESV has it. And God seeks what has been driven away. Now, one possibility is that he's recalling the repetitive nature of life under the sun, but now he's adding that God controls it. We don't control it. It's God who brings it around again and again. God's sending the sun around and around, right? So we don't control it. God brings it again and again. Another possibility is final judgment. Final judgment. We can't control the present, whether now or in the future. We'll keep facing the same old things. But one day, God will chase everything down and call the past to account. But that's how some of the English translations actually translated, he will call the past to account. Or, same scenario, we can't control the present, whether now or in the future, we'll keep facing the same old things, only this time the focus is God seeking what humans once pursued but could never hold on to. It's a way of saying he chases down the scattered pieces of our lives and gathers them into a coherent whole. So I'm more inclined to the second view. Verse 17 will soon speak about God's judgment. And chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, explain the whole point of the book. And when it does, it combines the fear of the Lord with final judgment. But in all three views, the primary point is the same. You're not in control, and time is in God's hands. I think David Gidson says it well. He puts it like this, in my finite story, I'm often left grasping after several different threads and cannot seem to weave them into one coherent whole. My story has broken characters, jarring interruptions, unexpected joys, relationships caught up in unresolved tensions and difficulties. My life story has unexplained contradictions. I have plenty of unanswered questions, and I have as yet unfinished chapters. But my story is not the story. The story reveals that there will be a time of judgment, and believers trust that judgment will finally prevail. A way of saying God will make all things right. I found these truths so liberating. Because no matter what comes our way, we know what matters most. Enjoy good, fear God. I'm not in control of how the next meeting will turn out. I'm not in control of how someone will apply or not apply my counsel. I'm not in control of the losses that might come. I'm not in control of how much longer my insomnia will last. I'm not in control of whether the melanoma will return. I can't control what tomorrow will bring. Some days I just don't know what to do next. But I can rest assured that time is in God's hands. He's directing it all. He's made everything beautiful in its time. So instead of frantically trying to control all the various outcomes, I'm freed to enjoy the present that He's given and to fear Him in it. Whatever times God appoints, we can enjoy good and we can fear God. And that's how wisdom teaches us to live. Father, I thank You for Your grace, the grace of this book called Ecclesiastes. It's a strange one, and one that's not always easy to take in. But I pray that it would continue to do its work in us, to make us wise as we look, as we live in this world that is both gift and groaning. Help us to look to You who is above the sun. Give us grace for each time we face ahead, and thank You that we have a high priest that's opened the way to Your throne of grace to find help in those times. It's in His name we pray. Amen.